myth of the Middle Ages was of man's fall, of all being born in original sin as a consequence. When they die, they will go to hell unless they are saved. They are saved by the Savior Jesus, who was crucified and founded the church. And through the sacraments of the church, salvation is achieved. This supported an enormous institution. The church and the whole civilization of the Middle Ages was based on this. And when that belief disintegrated, the culture disintegrated. It has disintegrated now. We're in what is called a wasteland. T.S. Eliot put his finger on it back there in 1922, I think it was. What is a wasteland? It's a wasteland of people living without aspiration, going through the routine of their lives, doing things they're told to do, because they don't have the courage to do something they want to do, which would be a little bit insane. We are in a realm that I would describe as a terminal moraine of myths. There are no end of destroyed mythologies around us. But the interesting thing about a mythological image is that you can interpret it in your own way. And I would say the way to build your myth is to follow your fascinations. One can see, looking at the young people today, the myths they're living by. I mean, everybody's going around in a masquerade. And the only ones that are hard to take are the ones who take their masquerade seriously. The real wonderful thing is to play a game. That's as man has developed always. In the very early days of our human race, people made believe they were animals. And that's how societies began. You have totemism, you have mask dances, you have all kinds of animal games that people are playing. And these are supposed to invite the animals, and they did. Then people began playing that they were plants, that if they buried themselves, they'd be born again, something like that. And so you played that game. Then about the middle of the 4th millennium B.C., it was realized that the planets moved at a mathematically determined rate through the fixed stars. And the great concept emerged of a cosmic order. And the cosmic order was illustrated in the sky. And it must now be repeated on Earth. And so people began making believe they were stars and suns and moons. We still take it seriously when somebody comes in wearing a crown saying, "I'm the sun girl," or something like that. But kings and queens do this in all seriousness and terrific pomp. And it's astounding how seriously things like this are taken. I had the experience some years ago of drawing up to the curb in my car, a little boy standing there in great rigidity. I was about to close the door, and he said, "You can't park here." I said, "Why not?" He said, "Because I'm a hydrant." Well, well, sometimes when I see clergymen, I wonder what they think they are and how seriously they take it. Now, it's no accident that we say make believe. Get it? People are playing a game. This is a myth world, that we're playing the game that man was made for certain purposes, and that's what we're doing. Now somebody comes in and says, "Oh, beans, this is all nonsense." Well, you're a spoil sport. You're spoiling the game. Get out of here. It's like somebody who'd start running back and forth while people trying to play a tennis game, running back and forth on the tennis court, busting up the game. Nothing nuttier than playing tennis. But it's great fun, and you believe it's worth winning, otherwise it wouldn't have worked so hard. So this whole thing of getting a belief into a life is the function of myth. Now, some beliefs are silly, some are very deep, and I want, in the concluding part of my talk, to speak about some of these depths. I want to speak about these depths in two contexts, one, that of the Hindu, and another, that of a recent contemporary Western psychological approach to the problem. The great summary book of the Upanishads, it's a small text, is the Mandukya Upanishad. And it's in this Upanishad that the word Om is explained, what it means. Om is the sound of the universe. It's the sound that is heard when your imagination wakens. It's the sound that converts an animal into a human being. On one level of life, we share the experiences of the animals. We sleep, we lust, we fight. That's our animal life. Then there may come the awakening of awe, a sense of mystery in the world, and that is when the sound Om is heard. The sound is pronounced starting in the back of the mouth, ah, ooh, mm. Ah is said to represent waking consciousness. This is worthwhile, what I'm going to tell you now. Ah is waking consciousness. In the world of waking consciousness, subject and object are not the same. I see you, you see me. We are not the same. A is not A. A rational Aristotelian logic prevails. The objects are gross objects. They are not self-luminous. They do not shine of themselves. They have to be illuminated from without. There are only three things that shine of themselves, or that were in the ancient world: the sun, lightning, and fire. And these are regarded as the entrances, the gates, to the world beyond the gross world in which we live. U is associated with dream consciousness. There's another logic here. And you know very well that your dreams are deeper and closer to you than what you see in waking life. They are the very intimate noise, you might say, of your own existence. In dream consciousness, the subject and object seem to be different from each other, but are not. You see the dream, and it's a surprise to you, but you made the dream. And it's right here on that dream level that these two levels of consciousness that I've been talking about meet: waking or seeing or witnessing consciousness, and the consciousness of your being. Dreams are self-luminous. They shine of themselves, as gods do. Myths are public dreams. Dreams are private myths. By finding your own dream and following it through, it will lead you to the myth world in which you live. But just as in dream, the subject and the object, though they seem to be separate, are really the same, so also you and your God, you seem to be separate, but you're really the same. Now, this God that I'm talking about is not the one that you're told to have as your God. I'm sure that from this place where I'm speaking, many people have had God delivered to them. But what is the God that actually you find in your own deep vision? The passage is from dream to vision to the gods, and they are you. All the gods, this is an Indian word I'm speaking about, all the gods, all the hells, All the heavens are within you. Now, we're taught that God and man in our normal biblical tradition are not the same. This is a mythology of the waking consciousness position. This is important. Our mythology has all been interpreted into waking consciousness symbols. And this is why suddenly the Oriental teachers are so attractive to us now. A lot of them are absurd human beings, but they have really something to deliver here. And what they have to deliver is this, that God is in you. It is not something that happened somewhere else a long time ago. It's in you. When you go into this great cave in the in India, the Elephanta Cave, on an island in the harbor of Bombay, there is a tremendous image at the back wall. It's a great three-faced form, which I'm sure most of you have seen. It's about 19 feet high and 19 feet across. In the center is an absolutely impassive face. At the right is a masculine profile. At the left, a feminine profile, male and female. Aggression and erotic bliss. And in the center is eternity, that mystery from which the pairs of opposites proceed, from which male and female proceed, from which life and death proceed, and so forth and so on. When you are looking at that figure, you are looking at God, the God that is within you. In the Sistine Chapel of Rome, you look up and there's that beautiful thing on the ceiling by Michelangelo of God creating Adam. When you look at that, you're not supposed to think God is there and Adam is there. You're supposed to think this is a picture of something that's supposed to have happened somewhere else a long time ago. That's one kind of religious experience, putting your deity way out there. But this Indian cave, you go into the dark, it's the dark of your own heart, and it's in your heart that your hands touch the feet, so to say, of the divinity. And it's there that you see the divinity, and what you feel is Shiva is here. Shiva is I. And that great word, Shivaham, I am Shiva, is the ultimate realization. Whereas in our tradition, if anyone says, I am God, he's either a maniac or a great, great saint, and in either case, he will be killed. Christ was killed when he said, I and the Father are one. Halaj was killed 900 years later when he said, I and my beloved are one. This was regarded as impudence, yet in these traditions that worked on the dream level, this is the truth of truths. This is what the gods and myths are all about. So find them in yourself and take them into yourself, and you will be awakened in your mythology and in your life. So much for ooh. Closes at the lips. Represents the level of deep, dreamless sleep. In deep, dreamless sleep, consciousness is still there, but it is covered over by darkness. But suppose you could find that consciousness. Suppose you could go into deep sleep awake. That's the goal of yoga. To go awake into that sphere where there is consciousness, but consciousness of no specific thing. All of our words refer to things and relationships of things. Things either in the field of waking consciousness or things in the field of dream consciousness. The ultimate is not of things. It is sheer, uncommitted, undifferentiated consciousness. And this is what is known as the silence that surrounds Om. So Om is said to be a four sound syllable. Ah, ooh, and the silence around it. Ah, the level of waking consciousness. Ooh, dream consciousness. Deep sleep. And the silence, that out of which the world comes and back into which it goes. Now, just one more point. When I'm looking at you, I'm looking at the past. That is to say, what I see before me has happened. Waking consciousness deals only with what has happened. Science deals with things that have happened. It can predict only what will happen if what will happen repeats what has happened. The absolute novelty science cannot predict. Dream consciousness is the present. It is becoming. It is your very becoming. And the person with an intuition on that level can intuit the destiny of nations. Deep sleep holds all that is future, because the future can come from nowhere else but the energies of the psyche. These, then, are the levels of waking consciousness, science, rational life, perfectly good. But don't try to interpret dream in terms of reason, and don't try to interpret religion in terms of reason. The religious imagery is telling you what is becoming. Reason tells you what has become and is going to have some surprises, as it always has had surprises. If you just want some good laughs, read some of the predictions in newspaper columnists of 30 or 40 years ago, and you'll find that has no relevance to what happened. The mystery of life is what is on the level of dream. Now let me turn from this to a contemporary psychologist who seems to me to be the one of whom you'll be hearing not very long from now. This is a man, Stanislav Grof, who has been treating deep psychosis and so forth with LSD treatments for something like 15 years. He is at the Maryland Institute of Psychiatric Research, which is one of the two places in this country that's allowed to administer LSD. It's done very, very carefully with controlled doses and by people who know what's going to happen and in a controlled environment. And as a result of all this, he has been able to discover levels of people's fantasizing. And what these levels represent are levels of expanding consciousness. The first effect, as everyone who's ever taken these things will tell you, is an astonishing sense of presence. Objects begin to shine, to be fascinating, things that you took for granted. There's a story I've heard of four bridge players who were made to promise before they received a shot that they would play a game of bridge after they received it. These are bridge fiends. They'd never done anything else in their life but play bridge. All right. They were given a slight dose just to kick them up a little bit. And the cards were dealt out. And when they opened the cards, they sat there fascinated. They didn't play bridge. This is what's known as aesthetic arrest. They were held. And what it represents, if nothing else, is a new activation of consciousness. We live with things thinking only of their uses, even our friends. But the experience of regarding somebody, I've had this happen with students, this stupid thing sitting in front of me week after week. And then one day my mind blanks out and I suddenly see, why, this is a presence. This is a miracle. It doesn't matter. As a student, nothing. As a human being, nothing very beautiful either. Just a mug there. But, oh my heavens, what a miracle. Don't need LSD to have that happen. So the first, level of activation is this of aesthetic arrest. This is what happened to Dante when he beheld Beatrice. Here was an object that normally would have been one to evoke erotic relationship. That wasn't what happened. He saw a miracle. This is what happened to Stephen Dedalus in Joyce's Portrait of the Artist as a Young Man when he saw the girl in the stream. Suddenly, a miracle of what something is. This is seeing the person as though it were a dream. And when we're in love with somebody, we say, you're my dream, or you're a dream walking, or something like this. You know, we get poetic as well as we can, and try to go past the rational realm. Might say, darling, you're like a rose. And then the next time a new inspiration comes, you're a swan. And she, being what she is, a stupid little thing, will say, well, make up your mind, which is it? And this is a girl with no possibility for a religious life. The next level of experience is one of psychological agony. This is the level of a Freudian analysis, when the consciousness expanding begins to bump up against all the taboos that have been built into you. And there's this agony of guilt and nausea, horrible experiences, before you break through that. This is the reliving of your personal unconscious, the reliving of your personal agony, your personal taboos, your personal experiences. This is what is regurgitated, so to say, in a Freudian analysis. But then there comes another level in these experiences, and it's a level of re-experiencing your birth. Because you did have an experience there. You did, indeed. Mother did, too. But you're the more important one right now. And Groff has found four stages in the birth experience which have been relived by his patients. And he's checked and checked and checked on this, so this is no nonsense. He calls these the basal birth models. Basic prenatal models. The first is that of the fetus in the womb. There's no sense of I or not I. There's just a being. There's no subject and object. This is the experience most like that of the mystic quenching the dewdrop into the sea. Neither I nor thee. We are both gone. The second stage is when the uterus begins to vibrate and the pains of the mother begin. There is no way out. Suddenly there is ego in trouble. The first experience we have of ourselves is of ourselves in trouble. And this can last quite a while. And there is considerable terror. And if the person finishes in that condition, let's say if the drug wears off and that's the condition the person comes out of it in, the person is in danger of a suicide. It will be a quiet suicide, pills or drowning or cutting the wrists or something like that. It's the experience of the existentialist. Life is nothing but pain, birth is pain, death is pain, nothing but pain between la vie est dure. The third stage is when the cervix opens and the birth begins. And this is a tremendous exercise. There's a collaboration between the mother and the child to a certain extent. There's a sense of something doing, getting somewhere. And it's violent, it's ugly, there are foul odors and experiences. This is the level of the sadomasochistic attitude. And if the person comes out in this state, the person's in danger of blowing things up, of blowing himself up, is a dangerous person. The fourth state is that of birth itself. Suddenly light, and suddenly an object, mother. The first divinity. And the only divinity, finally, really. I mean, this daddy thing is a joke compared with mother. he's no good there. Now, these four states are states that underlie whole life moods. They also underlie different mythologies. Now, here's the interesting thing. People in the states 2 and 3 These are the ones of pain, anguish, violence. Their fantasies are almost exclusively those of the Judeo-Christian tradition. Crucifixions, an angry God, a punishing God, tortures, hells, all kinds of violence. And just you read the Old Testament with that in mind, and you'll see that's a pretty good show. The tension between God and man, who are not the same. God made man to be his servant. You have disobeyed. You deserve punishment. All you deserve is rebuke. But when they get to either stage 1 or 4, the images are of the Orient. The peace of nirvana in the womb. The bliss of relationship to the mother goddess. In the East, the whole universe, the sphere of the universe, is the womb of the goddess. And the deities and all names and forms are within her bounds. The gods are her children. This is a primary mythology. This is the mythology from which all our mythologies come. But when the Hebrews came into the world of the goddess in the second millennium BC, they took the myths of the goddess and converted them into myths of the god. They did. This is a historical fact. And all of these father images just don't quite convince. Who wants Abraham's bosom? Whoever heard of a man giving birth to a woman? That serpent in the garden, he knew where he was. He was an old deity, Ningish Zidda, who was the consort of the goddess. And Eve was that consort. The serpent and Eve make a better pair than Eve and Adam. Serpent and Eve were at the tree of bliss. Adam and Eve are out there in the rock, in the rough, having a tough time. So that's what comes when the goddess goes in the wrong direction. But this finding of Groff's, I think, is fascinating. And what you will find from it is that the religion that you were taught committed you to a certain attitude toward life. You think it's tough. Because your religion's imagery says it's tough. Or you find it blissful and something you can rest on. Finally, after this stage of experiences, which we have all had, the person has gone past his personal life into the life of transpersonal experiences, one comes to suddenly a stage of understanding it all. You can't talk about it. It's just the rapture of seeing and knowing what it's all about and that it's good and that it's great. And for all the pains and all that, nevertheless, it is as it is. And it is a marvel. And the pains and the pleasures are not the ends you live for, but just the rapture of this beholding. They come to this. And finally, there's one stage still further beyond this one of symbolic rapture. It's that of a kind of metaphysical sense that you have struck the ground and you have found the root of being. These are experiences people have had, and they correspond to those of waking consciousness, the stages of mythic dream, and the deep sleep and the rapture beyond it.
You've been listening to The Vitality of Myth, the fifth talk by Joseph Campbell in the series entitled Mythology and the Individual. This recording was authorized by the Joseph Campbell Foundation and produced by Electronic Educational Programs. Our theme music is by Acoustic Alchemy. For more information on the work of Joseph Campbell, please call the Foundation at 1-800-330-MYTH, 1-800-330-6984, or you can contact us on the World Wide Web at jcf.org. I'm Maura Vaughn. Thank you for listening.